This episode of The Accidental Entrepreneur is brought to you by NowSite Marketing, the first all-in-one marketing platform powered by artificial intelligence. Bring all your digital marketing to a new level with their simple three-click method. And by Digital Accelerant, the digital mobile business card. Text the word LAW to 21,000 to get connected and learn how to get your own digital business card. And by Fetch Internet, the secure high-speed app that eliminates the need to pay for hotspots or use public unsecure Wi-Fi. Listen to all of our sponsors' commercials later in this episode and follow their links in the show notes to learn more about their products and services.
Is in marketing their firm, they'll say, I can get you a 12 times EBITDA multiple.
Right.
And so when I hear something like that, my first question is it EBITDA or is it transactional EBITDA?
Those are so different?
Yes, they're much different.
Okay.
And I think this is where business owners may be a little bit of a gap in their knowledge of those two terms. So EBITDA is easily calculated off of a financial statement. You take your operating income, you add back depreciation, you add back amortization, and that's basically your EBITDA.
Okay.
Okay. But then you have transactional EBITDA, which is where a firm like MidCap excels, where we'll look at your financial statement, we'll look at your general ledger, we'll do analytics, and we'll look for either suboptimal costs that are in your operation that are dragging down your profitability. We'll look at investments you've made, maybe in salespeople or a marketing person, or maybe you expanded some sort of a direct labor force that's dragging down, temporarily dragging down your profitability, but will enable you to either get into a new market or expand your revenue or what have you.
So you might add that back in because it was a temporary investment.
Correct. Okay. We would add that back in. We also see quite often from an accounting standpoint, most business entrepreneurs are not very good at focusing on accounting.
Right. Bookkeeping. They're terrible.
Fantastic with building a business, sales. Right. They're great at that. But the actual is not something that they're usually
very strong. And by the way, that's a little problematic because you're not dealing with a public company with audited financials. You're relying on, right? So it's your job to figure out what's right here, what's wrong, what's not real, all that kind of stuff, right?
Absolutely. And that's why diligence is a little different when you're dealing with private companies.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, we're...
The information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work, and they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode.
Hi, I'm John Poppe, a founding partner of MidCap Advisors and MidCap Equity Partners based in New York City. We're a middle market investment banking and direct investment firm headquartered in New York City. We focus on private companies in the lower middle market, and we help business owners determine the best way for them to transition their business from a succession planning standpoint, from a sales standpoint, and also to help identify growth opportunities.
All right, John. So thanks for joining me on the podcast. I know Jeff Brenner, I had met him through another networking group and he connected us and we had a call, but I thought it was very interesting what MidCap does. And maybe, I mean, it's a little bit different than some of the local entrepreneurs, but when you talk about people that are in the startup space, the tech space, you know, whatever, they're looking to grow their businesses, you guys evaluate those businesses. We could talk about how you value them and what people should do to improve their value and things, you know, what does people in your business look for? But maybe just as a little bit of background, you want to talk about, you know, where you grew up, where you're from, how you got into the financial business. I mean, we don't have to go back to like, you know, paper routes and, you know, when I used to do fishing rods when I was 12, but, you know, just give us an idea of like where you're from and so forth.
Sure. Well, from Staten Island, family still there, native Staten Islander, one of the few remaining. We're an endangered species, but purchased a home in New Jersey. So we are migrating, doing the typical Staten Island to New Jersey migration.
Right.
Boca, I guess, is 10 years out. I guess that's the next.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the middle ground in between those two.
That's the immigration. You're going to little.
There you go. That's the immigration. really have always been, had a love for business and always had focused on companies and how companies operate, how they run. And so it really interested me, I guess it really started in high school with doing title searches and the investigative aspect of doing title searches and finding kind of, if you will, due diligence
in
selling a house and buying a house. So that I guess really started my brain going down the road of kind of due diligence, if you will, and analyzing.
So in those days, you were doing research on properties, probably mostly residential properties, the history of those properties and who owned them, chains of title, all that type of stuff from the county records.
Absolutely.
And that was in Staten Island in New York?
Yes, in Staten Island, actually.
Okay.
The building boom in the mid-80s.
Okay.
You'd have to go all the way back to the 1700s, 1800s into the decrepit books and kind of start there and move forward. And,
right.
It was a very interesting job to have throughout high school. And then in college, I was fortunate enough to start as a freshman at a local bank. And that back then, banks had to join together to get a 1 gig hard drive because it was. and Lotus Symphony was the.
Lotus Symphony. Now you're dating yourself, definitely.
Absolutely.
That was before Lotus Notes, I think, right?
I think it was. It might have been competing, but
right.
A funny little story. My first week there at the bank, I accidentally deleted the budget program for the marketing department. And I was nervous, so I ended up taking the books home with me and learned how to program in Symphony. Not that I knew what the marketing program was at that.
Right.
Deleted it. And it took me about a week, but I created this incredibly over-engineered spreadsheet with various windows and what have you, and presented it to the executive vice president saying, hey, I saw the old one, and I think this is an improvement. And I entered all the data in, and he loved it. And I became the IT person for that bank, the go-to.
There you go. So Lotus Symphony, if I remember, is like Microsoft Excel. I mean, it was a spreadsheet program. You could do macros and programming, right? The whole thing.
Absolutely. And so I learned, I've always been a programmer, even back to the Apple IIe days, definitely dating myself. And so I used that skill set. And I think the reason why I'm bringing this up is it helped meld the way you can use technology to solve business problems.
Yeah.
And also being at a financial institution during college also enabled me to take what I was learning in academia and apply it to real world situations, including looking at acquisitions, doing zip code demographic analyses, things of that sort.
Right.
So it really was a nice meshing. And
When
I was graduating, fortunately, I was able to be accepted into the Chemical Bank Management Training Program in Manhattan. And
Chemical Bank, another bites the dust, right? Didn't they? Maybe they merged with somebody, or did they? Right?
They merged with Manny Hanny.
Okay.
they had headquarters on Park Avenue, directly across from each other.
And okay.
And I forgot how many hundreds of millions of dollars was spent and just kind of consolidating. So Chemical Bank had a great training program back then in the lower middle market for commercial lending. And so I went through that program. And interestingly, I look back at my career and I haven't made many changes, but the executive vice president at that local bank that I worked at while I was attending college, I mentioned I got into the training program and we were having dinner and he said, so what really drives you as a person, John? And if you were to ask me that question back then, it would be money. Money is money.
Of course.
Of course, right? Everyone would equate me to Alex P. Keaton from Family Ties.
There you go.
But he said, I want you to rank these 20 attributes. And so I did. And I've been with my wife since we're 16, been dating since we're 16 years old.
Wow.
So I also gave her the list.
Okay. Now you were still in college at this point, or you had graduated?
Just graduated.
Okay.
And we got married young, so we got married at 23. So
that's young.
Yeah, so I handed Jen a list, and I did a list, and we ranked them. And surprisingly, the top five attributes that were important to me was problem solving, challenge, family, power. Money was fifth. And it's like a light bulb went off. Like, oh, so money isn't what really drives me. It's the problem solving. It's the challenges. And I need to be in control of a situation. And by doing this exercise, and whenever I have an informational interview with a college student, I ask them what drives them.
Right.
Because I have to tell you, if I didn't go through that process, I don't know if I would be where I am today.
Right.
I started off very strong at Chemical Bank, far exceeded my new business development goals as a first year officer, but I went back to look at, oh, this is not really where I want to be in right. large corporate.
Some people take 20, 30 years to figure that out.
And I think it's such a disservice that colleges don't do this.
Right.
And I tell the person, do it now. Think about what it is that really drives you. May that a necessity need to go for the highest paying job. I get that. But just keep in mind what really drives you, because you don't want to be in your 30s or 40s and realize I'm not happy.
Right. I think, you know, it's really important where companies evaluate employees that they're the right fit and they have the same vision as your company. But yeah, you as the employee got to do the same thing. Are you the right fit for, do you want to be here? Is this just a job you're taking to be stuck in 20 years and be miserable? Because at the end, it's all ashes and dust, you know?
Yeah, it's well put. And it is one of the questions we ask when we're interviewing for people. We are not a large organization. We're 13 people. And so when we hire someone, it's really important that that's a good fit, because
right.
you spend a lot of time and effort and dollars bringing that person into the fold. And for them to leave in 6 months, a year, or even 2 years, it hurts.
Yeah, it's costly. It hurts emotionally, right? The team, it affects everybody.
And I'm really proud of the people at MidCap in that we're very entrepreneurial. Most of us have either owned businesses, operated businesses, in addition to being able to analyze, raise capital, and execute merger and acquisition transactions. So we bring a very comprehensive look at a business. So when we meet with a prospective client, we're not just looking through the lens of how do we transact.
Right.
We look through the lens of how does this business owner or owners maximize the asset that they've spent a good portion of their life building, and
right.
usually represents a significant portion of their net worth. So
always, yeah.
You know, so we come from a much broader perspective, and almost take a consultative view of engagements.
And so how long have you guys been together with MidCap? You started MidCap with some guys?
Yes, Doug Hendrickson and I, who we both met in Chemical Bank. Doug was a senior executive at Chemical, and we just hit it off.
So you guys go way back to...
Yeah, we became friends. Yeah, we go back to the early 90s.
Okay.
So Doug and I always had an entrepreneurial strip going through us, a streak going through us. And in 2004, we decided, let's get together.
Right.
At that point, we both left Chemical Bank. Doug left to buy an insurance agency and also build out an investment banking practice. And I left Chemical Bank to join one of my clients as their CFO. And so I was doing that for almost 10 years. So we decided to get together, and we've been together ever since. A fantastic partnership. We're very complimentary.
Right.
And just the two of us when we started. So well, not big, but you know, 13 people is not shabby either.
Right. But during those different times, you learned about, you know, financials and financial analysis and how to do all that stuff as a CFO. And he's doing investment banking, learning how to value businesses and what you look for and what metrics are important and, you know, how you get there, right? I mean, that was basically what you came together for.
Yeah, it's interesting. I started my MBA at Stern in the while I was at Chemical Bank. And because of the workload at the company I joined, I just didn't have time to continue my MBA. So I stopped for almost 3 years.
For people listening, the Stern School is the business school of NYU in the city, right?
Yes, that is correct.
Yes, correct. Okay.
And so they have a very strong part-time program. I was not willing to forego.
Yeah, a lot of people work and they're going to the, right, sure.
So, but I just was putting in 100-hour weeks. Not that you don't do that in
not including the school.
Not including the school.
Yeah, so that's hard.
And I just couldn't dedicate my time myself to school, so I stopped for 3 years. And it's interesting when I went back. You know, one of my goals was to finish my MBA before I turned 30. So I decided I have to go back, and so I did.
Goals are good.
Yeah, goals are good.
Or you never get back to it, right? You had a goal, you knew the time was coming, you're going to get it done. Because you're 40, you're not going back.
Not going back.
Right.
It was interesting that the case study, the way I attacked a case study when I was with Chemical Bank was strictly go to the financials, run ratios, look at trends. When I went back after that three-year hiatus, I looked at management, I looked at operations, I looked at sales strategy,
right,
and then I looked at financials.
Yeah, because those are the things that drive all those numbers, right? Without that, without the good people, the business isn't worth much. It's just numbers that are played with on paper.
Absolutely. And it was such a learning experience for myself that the numbers is the end result.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
That's a good point, right? They reflect the people that did the work behind the scenes to make them run if you know how to look at them correctly.
And of course, if you're making a series of bad decisions, your trends, your financial trends will show that.
Right.
Usually, you're seeing maybe the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of stuff below the surface.
Right. Sure. Absolutely. So, okay. So let's talk about that because, you know, the podcast definitely caters to, you know, small local business owners, small owners, entrepreneurs, things like that. But we also deal with a lot of, and I do as a business lawyer, deal with a lot of people in the tech space, a lot of people in the startup space, a lot of people that are looking to grow businesses and eventually sell them and so forth. And that's what you guys do. You evaluate, do you bring in private investors to invest in businesses and put syndicates together? Or do you really just do the valuation part, help them raising money and things like that?
No, we do investment also. In fact, we look at quite a few emerging businesses. We're not at this point really focusing on the pre-revenue type of opportunities.
Right, like startups is pre-revenue, right?
We will look at very select number of startups.
Right, there's always an exception.
There's always an exception, but for the most part, we're looking for emerging companies. And so we've seen
with earnings,
umpteen models,
right?
How they expect to scale the business and what have you. And I would say that we do investments. We've made two investments this year already. We have, I believe up to 10 holdings now. We're in the process of evaluating another one. So yes, we do not only evaluate the value of a company, we also do investments. And so I think that perspective enables us to look at a company and look at a business owner and say, you know, what do we think we would pay for this business?
Right. That's what valuation is all about. Right. Of course.
And could we defend that? Could I defend that with my investment committee? And we have very pointed discussions with prospective clients. We take on a select number of clients because we're not a huge firm. So
who's the client, the investor or the business owner?
The business owner would be the client.
Okay. Yep.
Investors, and it's interesting question you ask, because I guess in a way, because we do have a cadre of individual investors that we pull together for a specific investment.
Right. And
sometimes those are, if you will, my clients too. That being said, the mid-cap dollar is the same dollar as the investors putting in.
Right. I got it. But it's a syndicate of investors. It's not a pool. Like, you can't invest in your fund, anything like that. It's a private. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. All right. So you're getting back to the business owners, the clients, right?
Yes. I would say primarily it's the business owners. The vast majority of our transactional revenue comes from the sale of businesses.
Okay. So the investing side of it's the smaller part of the business. It's really the investment banking piece where you're evaluating the business, bringing it to market and coming up with what it's worth to sell and then finding sales. So are there any particular industries that you work in more than others?
We're very strong in the insurance services space, financial services.
Like an agency, like a brokerage house, things like that, or?
A property and casualty agency.
That has a book of business, things like that. Okay.
MGAs, managing general agents.
Sure.
Underwriters. So we're very experienced in that space. In fact, we started a buy-side due diligence practice, and which is booming, and it's specifically targeted towards buy-side due diligence for insurance agencies.
Meaning agencies that don't want to acquire other books of business. That's common in the P&C business. Other parts of insurance, you can't do that. But in the property and casualty business, it's very common, right, to grow by acquisition.
Absolutely. There are several large aggregators in the marketplace.
Right. And
so we have built a very nice business there. And when I say we, Frank Robertson, one of the partners of MidCap, and Ryan Sanford have really spearheaded that initiative. And
got it.
Within MidCap.
Right. So basically they're hiring you to consult, to look at, I mean, are you finding the targets for them, or are they identify a target and they're like, listen, John, bring your people in, tell us what it's worth.
Yes. No, typically they are finding the opportunities. Maybe another investment banker has brought the opportunity to them, and then they're bringing us to do due diligence. This happens often. There are other investment banks that have consulting arms, and when we're bringing an opportunity, they're doing the due diligence.
Right. Because it's not right. You can't serve both masters, right? It's a bit of a conflict of interest to be the investment banker and then telling them what it's worth.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously consulting's worked on either flat fees, hourly fees, or whatever for the job. And if you're investment banking, are you getting a piece of the deal? Is that the way that works on a percentage basis when they sell the business or they make the acquisition? Or
there's a retainer, a non-refundable retainer, and that's flexible.
Okay.
And in there, we get a percentage of a closing transaction. The vast majority of our revenue on a sale transaction is coming through success.
Of course. Well, that's how, you know,
the retainer
make more money probably, that way.
Yeah, it's nothing more than maybe
cover your costs.
Not even to cover our costs, because I think our real costs are significantly above the retainer.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we use it as a, whenever someone has to write a check out.
Yeah, it means they're serious, right?
Yeah, the moment of, okay, am I going to write this?
Right, am I really going to do this or not? And if you never get there, they don't, yeah. That's probably true in all kinds of sales business, right? If you don't really get somebody to put something on the table, skin in the game somehow, where they have to make a decision where they now have something to lose if they decide not to go forward with this or whatever, you do all this work, yeah, at least they think twice about it.
Yes. And I think it is the actual act, because the dollar amount, MidCap's not keeping our lights on because of retainer fees.
Right.
There are some banks out there that make a lot of money on their retainer fees. We just don't have that business model. We believe in ourselves. We believe in the quality of our work. We believe in how we can maximize value for our clients through transactional value, that we're willing to put the risk on the success of closing a deal.
Okay. So maybe, I don't know if you're prepared to do this, because I don't remember what I told you to be prepared for, but without disclosing like names of businesses and, you know, breaking people's privacy protections, maybe there's a couple of businesses we can talk about in different industries. Like, you know, how do you generally value that business? So if I'm a business owner and I have, you know, operating businesses with EBITDA, with earnings, how do I go about in my mind to start the thought about, well, you know, what is my business worth? Because I from experience know that business owners more often than not overvalue their business. They think it's the greatest thing. Everybody's going to pay, you know, 20 times their earnings and gross earnings, right? And you see this on like Shark Tank, where people come on and they want to sell you 5% of their business for $100,000. And you start doing the math, you're like, well, that's like $2 million. And you haven't had any sales yet. So I don't know where they're coming up with these formulas. I think they're just making them up, to be honest with you. But that's why I want to have that discussion. That's why I wanted to bring you on, because I think it's a valuable thing to have a discussion about, right?
Sure. No, absolutely. And I guess two numbers that business owners typically reference is, well, not even two, it's one, it's EBITDA multiple. We hear right. that often.
Right. And, you want to tell everybody what EBITDA stands for? Because
sure. What it really stands for is kind of a proxy for your operating cash flow. So it's earning before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization.
Okay.
And so for a company that's not capital intensive, it is used as a down and dirty way of saying this company generates X amount of operating cash flow.
Okay. Right.
If you have a company that's very heavily involved with capital, let's say a machinery, and every year they have to put X dollars into new equipment
right.
in order to generate cash flow.
Yeah.
EBITDA might not be a very good metric for
right, operating. Because that doesn't measure the reinvestment in capital.
Correct. Absolutely.
Got it.
So then you would look at maybe free cash flow.
Okay.
But the reason why I bring up EBITDA multiple, and it's either verbalized as EBITDA or EBITDA.
EBITDA is a common term in your business when it comes to valuation. You hear it all the time with private equity groups, right?
Absolutely. And okay. So what we hear, and I think what sometimes people do, is in marketing their firm, they'll say, I can get you a 12 times EBITDA multiple.
Right.
And so when I hear something like that, my first question is it EBITDA or is it transactional EBITDA?
Those are different?
Yes, they're much different.
Okay.
And I think this is where business owners may be a little bit of a gap in their knowledge
okay.
of those two terms. So EBITDA is easily calculated off of a financial statement. You take your operating income, you add back depreciation, you add back amortization, and that's basically your EBITDA.
Okay.
Okay. But then you have transactional EBITDA, which is where a firm like MidCap excels, where we'll look at your financial statement, we'll look at your general ledger, we'll do analytics, and we'll look for either suboptimal costs that are in your operation that right. are dragging down your profitability. We'll look at investments you've made, maybe in salespeople or okay. a marketing person, or maybe you expanded some sort of direct labor force that's temporarily dragging down your profitability, but will enable you to either get into a new market or expand your revenue or what have you.
So you might add that back in because it was a temporary investment.
Correct. Okay. We would add that back in. We also see quite often from an accounting standpoint, most business entrepreneurs are not very good at focusing on accounting.
Right. Bookkeeping. They're terrible.
Fantastic with building a business, sales.
Right.
They're great at that. But the actual
minutia
is not something that they're usually
and, very and by the way, this that's a little problematic because you're not dealing with a public company with audited financials. You're relying on right. So you have it's your job to figure out what's right here, what's wrong, what's not real, all that kind of stuff, right?
Absolutely. And that's why diligence is a little different when you're dealing with private companies.
Yeah.
So yeah, what we're very good at doing is pulling out information to say, is there maybe a mistiming of revenue against expenses? Quite often we ask a business owner, are your financial statements accrual-based or cash-based?
Right. Explain what that is so people know.
Sure. So there are two different accounting methodologies. And most private companies, I would say, are largely cash-based.
Right.
You get a dollar in.
You book it.
You record that as revenue. You send out 50 cents. You record that as
expense.
Today.
Yeah.
You're not spending your time thinking about the dollar I got in today. Well, that's for a contract that covers 3 months.
Okay.
So I should only record 33 cents today.
Right.
Next month, another 33 cents and so forth. So I always pause with accounting because I remember this very well-established gentleman explaining his accounting system. So, gentleman in Brooklyn. He had one of those old steel desks. And
this was his business. He's the business owner.
He's the business owner. And, okay. And the private equity firm asks him, so what's your accounting system? This man's very wealthy. He creaks open his left drawer.
Uh-oh.
Creaks open his right drawer. And he says with an accent, you know, money goes in here. Money comes out of this drawer.
Right.
There's more money in this drawer.
Yeah.
And I pause because it's like, it really is that simple.
It is, really.
When you think about running a business, you know, how much cash do I have in my bank account?
Right.
That being said, when you're dealing with lenders, you're dealing with due diligence firms, they need to be sure that the financials properly reflect the future.
Right.
Kind of what are they buying today?
Yeah, they're looking for potential.
Correct. They're looking for potential. They're looking for off-balance sheet liabilities. They're looking for mistimings. Did this company happen to receive an extraordinary amount of cash over the last 12 months that would not be repeated going forward?
Not normal, right. Yeah. So, are off-balance sheet liabilities? Liabilities they didn't disclose that aren't booked?
So one good example would be warranty liability.
Okay.
A product company.
Oh, right. Yeah. You get all these returns and you got to fund them and deal with them and on your own dime.
Most often people are not, because it's not a big dollar amount.
Yeah.
They're usually not booking a liability for it.
Right.
So we often see in diligence that if you're selling X amount of product, there should be a certain percentage using historical norms that you would reserve to say, I'm going to have to.
Returns and replacements. Yeah, of course.
We see that often. We see often people not accruing accrued vacation or
okay.
Things of that sort.
And now a word from our sponsors. NowSight Marketing, the first all-in-one marketing platform powered by artificial intelligence. It's everything you need to market online, and it's totally automated. Build custom websites, optimize them for Google rankings, and automatically create ads and social media posts to drive the most traffic to your sites. Their fully integrated system generates regular email newsletters, manages all your customers and prospects, and provides up-to-date marketing analytics. NowSight. You do your thing, and we'll do the marketing. Use our affiliate link in the show notes to learn more about NowSight and how it can help your business. Uplift your marketing and reinforce your brand with a digital business card from Digital Accelerant. Use a text marketing combination to stand out in front of your competition. Digital business cards make you memorable and most of all help you bring in new business through its warm lead generator. Motion graphics, intro, outro, and inspirational videos can be added during setup. Text the word LAW to 21000. That's LAW to 21000. Or follow our link in the show notes to learn how you can get this valuable tool for you and your company. Suffering from slow internet speed? Worried about hackers? Fetch Pro gets the internet from your smartphone to your Windows and Mac computer without paying for a hotspot. Always get the fastest, most stable, and secure internet access on your computer with Fetch Pro. Follow their link in our show notes to learn more and get connected with Fetch. And now back to our show.
Unfunded pension liabilities for bigger companies, maybe, right? For
bigger companies, although luckily we're seeing less and less of that.
Yeah, I know. It's because the laws have changed, right? Yes. Okay, well, that's all great stuff. So let's keep going. So now you're talking about, you're with the guy, he's got the drawers, and that's not good enough. So where do you go from there?
So, well, and we actually sold two companies last year without financial statements. They had to
really?
Yes, no financial statements.
Well, you weren't investing in them, though. You were selling them.
We were not, but I would not be opposed to investing into one because okay. What you do in that case is you look at bank statements. Going back to the two draws, right?
Right.
Give me your bank statements.
Sure.
From that, I can see deposits. I can see withdrawals.
Right, real cash flow.
You just do a basic proof of cash and you determine, you know, you want to make sure that the deposits are not coming from a related company. It's actually
right.
Third party. So you have to do due diligence on it. But you can go back even without financial statements to look at bank statements.
I think that's a common problem with business owners is that they, especially smaller business owners than you would probably invest in, they have a claim of certain amount of cash, you know, because they're not reporting everything. So, but you can't make a business decision, even if you're just buying a local franchise, you're buying a local business, based on that kind of a representation. That's a real dangerous way to get into a business, unless it's something like it's the catering business and you know the business, you've been in all your life and you know this guy pulls out $500,000 in cash a year and you know how to do it. That's different. But for the most part, if you're buying a pizza parlor and the guy says, listen, you know, 2/3 of our pizzas are, you know, they walk out the back door, it's all cash, you get a lot of cash, and he can't prove it to you. I think it's a real dangerous way to get into business.
It is. And we don't deal with the pizzerias or the small companies. Usually our clients are north of $1 million of EBITDA.
Right. But you could be dealing with a company that's got 50 pizza locations and they're selling the whole thing and they're going to obviously do things legitimately and have it.
And I was about to say that we do have companies where there sometimes is a cash room. And what
I'm gonna blindfold you before I take you to that room, right?
And I go back to my credit days at Chemical Bank, and one of the C's that you had to look at for credit was character.
Yeah.
And when I hear about, hey, you know, I'll only show that I make X, but I own 4 houses, I have this and I have that, and there's a reason why I have that stuff, and you have to kind of use that as a basis to determine how much cash I really generate. It does speak to a certain extent to the character of the person.
Right.
And no matter how strong your purchase agreement is from a legal standpoint, at the end of the day, the last thing a buyer or a seller wants to do is actually pull out that document.
Right. Never. Right. Never. Because things have gone awry if you're pulling it out.
They really have. Yeah. They really have. I remember one of my first acquisitions, it was at the 11th hour. And the buyer just said, I don't think I can do this. And we were in heated discussions about the purchase agreement. So I hopped in my car.
You represent the seller at that?
In this case, this was the company we were buying.
Oh, so you were buying and this was, okay.
And I'm using this as an example of character. And yeah. It pertained to laws. It pertained to the representation that the company was abiding by all laws.
So this is why the guy was balking at the purchase.
He was balking. He was the seller. We were the buyer. We were asking him to represent that his company
was in compliance with, right?
In compliance with all laws.
He wouldn't do it.
And you, as an attorney, I'm sure can understand how using the word all,
right?
You know, you don't have any materiality qualifier or anything in that. It's a pretty, it's a tough hurdle,
right?
To say all.
I mean, you could say to the best of his knowledge, so we know he's not lying and committing fraud.
Yep. And then his knowledge qualifiers there also.
Of course, yeah.
So, but it
known or should have known, you know, type of stuff.
It was a very contentious segment of the negotiation.
Right.
And he ultimately called me and said, John, I can't do this.
Who's talking to you? Is that your buyer?
No, the seller.
And this seller calls you, said, you're buying, your group's buying. He says, I can't do this. Okay.
Yeah, because we're fighting over this language.
Right, right. It does come down to that sometimes, yeah.
Yeah. I hopped in my car, and I went down here, and we did the eyeball test.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you think I'm trying to hurt you, then let's not do this deal.
Yeah. Well, you got to figure out what's holding him back. Is it something that he's hiding that can get you in trouble later on, or is it some other reason, right?
Yep. And we hashed it out. Because it was about the character. And nothing happened after we bought the company. There was nothing wrong.
There was no issue. Now, why was he hesitant to make that representation?
Because he just said, John, I don't know. We're a national company. I don't know if in this little locale,
right,
we're not abiding by some regulation. And so I had to emphasize the fact that there were buckets that would deal with that, deductibles that would deal with that, immaterial issues.
Right, exactly. Okay.
Yeah, but it came down to the character of the people.
Right.
That's very important. So when someone takes home a lot of cash and effectively may not be reporting that cash,
right,
you need to be very careful, because you need to be careful about how the buyer is going to perceive that.
Right.
Can I trust anything else you're saying?
Yeah, of course. That's a huge problem.
Yeah, it is. So in any discussion, any negotiation, at the end of the day, people are still really important.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the difference between acquiring assets from the company and acquiring the company itself. Because if you acquire the company itself, you may be aware of like a lawsuit that is lingering out there, and this person either hasn't told you about or doesn't know about. It's always very dangerous. Yeah, absolutely. I find that with startup businesses, which you're obviously less often dealing with, character is even more important, right? Because if there aren't any earnings, if it's a concept, if it's the ability to execute a concept, put a team together, whatever it happens to be, the character of that person, I mean, that's really what you end up investing in very often, right? You're investing in the person, who they are, what they are, are they honest? Do they have the skills to do and, pull off what you're investing in? Because I think a lot of people get involved with, you see this too, where they get involved in some private subscription deal. They're putting money into a startup company of some sort or an invention of some sort, which you and I both know are flyers to begin with in most cases. But they spend too much time looking at what they think is a product or a concept that's being presented to them by somebody, right? The salesperson, the guy who's driving the business. But you really got to look at his character, because that's all you're going to be able to really evaluate. You don't have financials yet, And I think they do that on Shark Tank, on TV. I think a lot of these people with these newer businesses, because very few of them have a lot of earnings and stuff, I know they don't spend 7 or 8 minutes with them as we see on TV. I understand several hours, but still, how much do you so they're evaluating the character of the person and who they are, and their family values and this and that. And I think even with larger EBITDA transactions, that's important too, especially if the person's staying on with the business, right?
Absolutely. Even larger businesses have, usually with middle market companies, the personality of the founder permeates. It's part of the ethos of the business.
Yeah.
And it speaks to the quality of the company. So character is very important. It's just not the smaller size. It's also the larger. And then you start dealing with second line management and succession and what have you. So yeah, at the end of the day, people still really matter.
A lot.
Sometimes we lose focus on that because we deal with technology so often, but
Right. Still
about people.
Of course. I mean, look, companies don't run themselves. They're not entities that exist like a robot created the company. There's no people involved. I think more companies, and some of them are very good at it, but I think if more companies made decisions as if people mattered, mm-hmm. quality of life, where they work, life, work balance, all that type of stuff, you want to be a company that attracts people. So if you're looking to purchase a company, let's say, and you're evaluating the company, you also want to look at, right, what is their brand to the employee world? Like, do people like being there? Do they stay? How long do they stay? Will you be able to hire the new people as they develop this other line of business? I don't know, whatever it happens to be, because then you're dead in the water if you can't get the people to stay and be on there. Turnover's, I'm sure, a key factor, right?
I would think so. And it definitely is. And with COVID, it's going to be interesting to see how the work world emerges from this.
Yeah.
Will companies force the old way? People are changing the way they live right now, right?
Correct.
The work environment is now intermeshed with the personal requirements.
Yep.
So there might be, at 11 a.m., you might need to do something that's not business related at home because, but the business day
is
much longer.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you're going back to your office, you're not going to have that. So will this stay at home create a new requirement, if you will, of professionals saying, hey, I want to work at a firm that allows me to do what I've been doing for the last 3 months.
Right.
You know what? I'm actually pretty darn productive.
Yeah.
And home life is better. I'm actually eating dinner at 6 o'clock at night with my family. And I kind of don't want to give that up.
I think also employees are being more productive now because of that reason, right? You get longer days, but you can work it around your life and you can run out to pick up your kid at school and then come back and jump on a Zoom call or whatever. I think there's going to be a balance, but I think from a legal standpoint, you're going to see a lot less companies that make demands on their employees that, look, because you got a lot of liability if the choice you give to an employee is you either come back to the office or you're fired, that there's no consideration for that, right? So if they do come back to the office because they don't have really other choices, I think you're going to get, there's going to be employment law claims. I think there's going to be lawyers that say, hey, you have a claim here. You know, they put you in this position and now you're sick. You're in the hospital. You've infected your mother. She's now sick because she's elderly. But I see a lot of employers surveying their employees and saying, hey, would you like to stay home forever? Would you like to come back to work on a regular basis? Or would you like something in between? And I think a lot of them are falling in the in-between world. I mean, maybe not initially because they're all still nervous, but as I think people will want to work from home, but they don't want to work from home forever, right? They want to be crazy. They want to get into the office 1 or 2 days a week, 3 half days, whatever it happens to be, so they can balance their life. And maybe similar to parts of Europe, we're going to an economy where we don't live to work. We work to live, you know? And I think that's all good things if there's any kind of silver lining that's coming out of this whole craziness.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how the history books write this.
I mean, it also increases competition, right? Because if you can let people work from home and there's somebody in Oregon that you want to hire and you're in New York, you didn't have access to that person before without transferring them here. Now, that might not be the case.
Absolutely. You know? I believe there's a study, I probably shouldn't bring it up because I can't reference the actual study, but if my memory serves me correct, the only thing you lose by working out of your home is the creative aspect of the ad hoc
collaboration.
The collaboration.
Right.
So, and I can understand that. I see with MidCap, we're doing extremely well. Now, deals have slowed down as far as closings because they've been stretched out.
Right.
As far as volume, as far as activity, we are very, very busy.
Yeah.
And I think we're being very productive with how we're performing as a firm and as individuals. But there is that missing element.
Yeah, the camaraderie, the collaboration, the seeing each other, the sitting down to, hey, John, what do you think of this type of a thing, right? The whiteboarding, I've used that term loosely, but I agree 100%. I think that'll make a shift. And I think like these Zoom meetings and Teams is big because you can all be on the same domain and on all day and things like that. It's still not the same as like, you know, popping in the shoulder and, you know, saying, hey, grab me a cup of coffee over there, whatever. It's just not the same.
No, definitely not.
But we're going to have to learn to, you know, what choice do we have? We're going to get another virus?
I mean, and it's one of the, with business owners, it's another one of these D's, if you will, that have to be dealt with. And by D's, I mean, when we deal with business owners, the owners that maximize their transactional value are those that usually are thinking about a sale of their business in the future.
Right.
Not today.
Right.
But quite often, there are things that happen to a business owner or owners that force them to sell. And it might not be at an optimal time. So right. Now, 5Ds are well known for years. And I'll just quickly go through those, but I've added two more. But you know, the 5Ds of death, disability, divorce, disagreement, and departure.
Yeah.
Those are kind of well known, and those are things that occur where it disrupts the business unexpectedly,
right,
and causes potentially a suboptimal result.
Right. By the way, that's what buy-sell agreements are for. They address those 5Ds for people listening.
Now, absolutely.
Yeah.
And a good buy-sell.
Right. A good one. Right.
So, Mitch, I'm sure you've done your fair share of those.
Yeah, a lot of them. Right. Yeah. Exactly. But you're right. Those things happen if there's no plans in place. The whole company could collapse.
It could collapse. And so I added disruption as a 6th D. I added that about 2 years ago because you're seeing technology change, change industries, even if potentially it's in the gray area of legality.
Like right.
If you look at Airbnb, what they were doing probably wasn't within the guidelines of the law.
Probably not. No.
But consumer demand, made it happen.
Right.
And so disruption is another D that if you're not proactive could adversely affect a business. The 7th D is disease.
Yeah, I was going to say probably disease.
Disease. And that is.
But unless you worked in the infectious disease industry, right? before this, you probably didn't know, you know, what was going on. I didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't see Bill Gates's talk from 2015 where he said, listen, I don't think it's war we're going to have to worry about. I think it's like a virus. Now people think he like created it, which is stupid, but yeah.
Yeah, no, it's we're all Monday morning quarterbacks sometimes, right? And but yeah, but disease, you know, when this first started, we put out a paper because our concern was that you have an unknown restarting of the economy. And our concern was that business owners, once they started seeing the economy reopen, would just rush to going back to business as usual and bringing back all their employees. And our concern was not the, could they get through the period of time?
Right.
Was that a necessity? We felt like they would get through it one way or the other. Now they might be, they might lose a lot of muscle in the process.
Right.
But most companies over years, especially entrepreneurial businesses, have a layer of fat.
Yeah.
Hers.
Yeah. The ones that have EBITDA and earnings. Yeah, sure.
Because they're not, and even publicly traded companies have a lot of fat, I'm sure, but there's situations other than financial for reasons, for the basis of why things happen within a private company.
Right.
So we felt like there'd probably be enough fat for them to cut to get through a period of time, as long as it was a short enough period of time. Our real concern was that once the economy reopens, if they rush back to the running their business the way they've always run it, they might have an overcapacity issue. They might bring back people too quickly.
Right.
They could burn through working capital very quickly in that manner. So we put out a paper saying, look at your business in 25% demand increments.
Yeah.
You know, kind of do a step function to see how you would restart your business. And through that process, you might be able to determine, there's certain layers of fat that I don't need at 25.
Yeah, right. I don't need 10,000, 100,000 square feet of office space.
Yep. You can do with kind 10. Of build back into it.
Yeah. Or you could do with 10 and keep people home half the time. I don't know. That's going to the we're going to go into a recession, and certain parts of the economy are going to just get clobbered. Some will thrive. Online businesses, logistics, warehousing. I think office space is going to transform significantly. There's going to be obviously a home-based business market for people working at home, even through companies, right? So a company may not lease large copiers anymore. What they may do is lease smaller all-in-one units for their 150 employees that work from home half the time to give them, you know, there's going to be a big shift in that regard. But I think that your foresight was a good one because, look, Nat, we didn't know at that point, but obviously they're being forced to come back slowly anyway by the government orders and things like that. But yeah, you open up tomorrow, you go back to full capacity in terms of spending the money you're making. It doesn't mean it's not going to be coming in right away.
No, absolutely not. And you don't even know the health of your customer base.
Yeah.
There's just so many layers. And that's what makes, not that I'm a stock market guru by any stretch, I'm just confused with what's going on right now.
It's very hard to predict.
Most of the people I'm talking to don't understand this run up in the market either. Because if you really start to look at the amount of pain that is probably going to take place,
yeah,
it's significant.
And a lot of it's institutional. I mean, that's usually what drives the markets, right? So they're usually doing the analysis. You wonder, you know, what the thing I think people don't realize. So if you look at just the stay at home issue, right? So if you're staying home more, you're working from home, you're spending less money on gas, we have less car accidents, less auto repair, right? So the price of gas goes down, auto body shops aren't making money, dealerships, not as much wear and tear on your car, your tires don't wear out, all that stuff goes down, which you save, but business owners suffer. But then like insurance companies are going to be making a fortune because they're going to have lower claims, which hopefully they will reduce and lower premiums, but you know, so it's this balancing of the things that happen just because you say to yourself, wow, I can stay home now and I don't need to go to this store and that store and it's more convenient for me. Well, it's going to have a negative effect on whatever it's positively affecting you, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And you are seeing auto insurance companies giving back premium dollars. You are seeing that.
Sure.
I personally wonder if we're going to see healthcare carriers giving money back.
Yeah.
Premium dollars. Now, granted, the expenses related to COVID are enormous.
Right.
But non-COVID medical, well, a lot of those expenses have subsided, right? Right. A lot of the claims have subsided because it's all been COVID for the last 2+ months.
Right. Plus, I'm sure people aren't getting as sick as much because they're not interacting so much, right? The flu season may be not so bad this year. I don't know.
It'll be interesting to see the medical loss ratios and if there's any issues that pop up later on. That being said, you look at some of the publicly traded healthcare carriers, they're doing incredibly well. So.
Yeah, no, I've never seen any of them lose money.
That's true.
You know, drug companies, all that kind of stuff. I think that's another thing that from an economic standpoint, we're going to have to reevaluate our global, supply chain system. So we're not, you don't want to be reliant on other countries. If something happens where China shuts down again, and you can't get raw materials to make drugs or things like that. I don't know how you deal with that, but that's what caused a lot of this stuff. People travel the world and everybody's going back and forth in business and we're all a global economy.
Yeah, it's hard to parse out the political aspects to these and the financial. We all need each other. I mean, I think it's pretty apparent we are a global economy.
Yep.
And we all are better off working together in some capacity. But the political environment with the isolationism and the nationalism, it's now becoming an issue where in diligence, people are looking at supply chains and the riskiness of those supply chains when it comes to national
crises. Yeah, absolutely. Well, John, I appreciate it because I think that this is valuable for people to understand, what to look at when it comes to their business and, that it comes down to what you can show people what your business is worth and don't overvalue what you think is what other people will pay. I mean, I think there's people I don't think they're going to sell their business right now. I think they might have to shut down their business, but I talked this morning, I was mentioning to you on my update, and this will be interesting because I told you this will come out in the fall. So we'll see where we are at that point. Hopefully, we've come back a ways. Things are open. Money's flowing, right? Because you and I both know the health of the economy is directly reflected by the speed in which money changes hands, right? So if I'm getting paid slowly by my clients, I'm paying my bills slower because I'm worried that I won't have any money in between for emergencies or whatever. Sure. So hopefully they loosen up as we go. So are there any industries that you're looking at in particular that you like right now from a investment or purchase standpoint?
I wouldn't say any specific industries. Big data is definitely an area that we really like because of what's happening with 5G and just the value of many of these companies pertains to the data they're collecting. So we like big data.
That's good to know. My son's an informatics major in college, so
it's a great major.
All big data. So I'm glad he's in a good place.
In a very good place. I tell my 10-year-old to just programming and data analytics.
Right. Yeah.
So, of course, she doesn't listen to me. but I wouldn't say at MidCap, we do like education. We like insurance, of course. But I think we're more.
When you say education, what do you mean?
Education. We have investments in several tutoring type of companies, learning companies. So we like the education space. We own second largest music instrument rental business in the country.
Oh, okay.
So we like the education space. Obviously, that's an area going through a lot of changes.
Right. But we're not going to stop educating our children. I mean, that's clear. So
no,
how we do it may be different, but yeah.
Absolutely. Right. I wouldn't say specific industries. I think every industry has opportunities right now.
Yeah.
Whether you're a strong company with weaker competitors because you happen to be not as levered as they are right now. So maybe the industry itself that you're in isn't the best right now because of COVID or
that could be opportunities for you.
You can have opportunities.
Right.
It all comes down to, and we do this with most of our engagements, it comes down to net present value. And
right.
I hate to fill it down to a financial number, but it really, you take all of the risks of the future and the possible, do I keep running my company? Do I sell my company? Do I sell a company in 2 years? Do I buy a competitor? All of these factors we take and we say, okay, let's look at the various opportunities and let's distill it back down to today's dollars.
Right.
And with the risk you're taking on or laying off, or what is each of these opportunities worth to you?
Right.
A lot of times business owners they're so growth oriented. Sometimes they don't step back and say, hey, what does this mean for me right now? Is that the right decision?
Yeah.
We help them with that process.
Okay. Well, that's good advice. So, John, I appreciate you spending time with me on the podcast today. And
if you like our podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review and feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at info@beinhackerlaw.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur is a production of Mitchell C. Beinhacker. If you'd like more information about Mitchell and his practice, you can find him on social media or visit his website at beinhackerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.